My name's Andy Gordon, and this is session N. I don't know. Five, six, I don't know. In a series that I've been trying to develop on perspectives on reality, essentially, on information processing, on how people and organizations make good decisions. We've taken a particular tack here that's looked at a variety of situations where things have fallen down. And we've tried to look at that falling down conceptually, trying to understand its roots. And my major emphasis at the beginning was that many times when it looks like an organization, when a person has failed, when they've, for example, in an organization said they've done something and written that they've done something else, that there's often a reason for that that transcends the person. They're caught in a situation out of which they could not escape. I gave some examples that were rather extraordinary in the first couple sessions, which we will be coming back to, but I know a lot of people are new as with the hold and turnover. So I'm going to begin by an illustration. This is a multimedia presentation. All you people will be sorry you're sitting there because we're going to watch a little video a little later too. The first thing, now what we're going to hear first is the report of the, was it the Rogers Commission on the debacle with the last space launch where the several astronauts were killed, seven astronauts were killed. Do you remember there's been this group that's been investigating that problem and trying to decide what happened? And recently they've concluded that it was the rings that failed. That's interesting technically. I'm much more interested in how it is that that was not known earlier, because it was clear that those rings were troubled for a long time. What I'd like to play is a short excerpt from the report of the one scientist, I think Nobel Prize winner, that distanced himself from the report of the Rogers Commission, because it raises some issues which I'll then talk about very quickly and then move on to some other things. So let me see if my little pocket machine is hearable.
Yesterday, the Rogers Commission released its
report, I bet you can't hear it,
investigation of the Space Shuttle Challenger. There was general agreement among commission members of...
Fortunately, that doesn't amplify anything in this room.
Everybody is super quiet. I think you can hear.
Yeah, why don't we try? Because it is, I think it would be useful. Let's give it a shot. And if I will summarize it at the end. Essentially, this woman from National Public Radio is now saying the commission has reported.
Official conclusion. But one of the members, Nobel laureate Richard Feynman, wrote an additional personal report, which he released today at a news conference at Caltech in Pasadena, California. NPR's Laurie Garrett was there.
If there is one thing that gets physicist Richard Feynman's goat, it's bad science. And according to Feynman, NASA is full of bad science. Feynman says on nearly every aspect of safety evaluation of the space shuttle, politics forced adoption of scientifically unsound safety evaluations. For example, Jackson Lovinggood of the Marshall Space Flight Center testified to the Rogers Commission that NASA believed the chances of a shuttle explosion were 1 in 100,000. That would mean, calculated Feynman, that NASA could operate the shuttle for 300 years without an accident.
Can you hear that? Okay.
Feynman questioned Lovinggood's logic.
When I looked at it, I saw what looked to me like considerable flaws in the logic by which he obtained that. The way he reasoned, he said he didn't want to use mathematical methods, he was going to use engineering judgment. And as far as I could tell, the engineering judgment, so-called, consisted of making up numbers. There was no way to tell whether they were right or wrong. And they were not based on experience, but on engineering judgment. It's odd that the engineering judgment was not the same as the judgment of the engineers.
Feynman repeatedly stresses that engineers low on the totem pole in NASA and inside NASA contractors were issuing warnings. One told Feynman the chances of an accident were perhaps 1 in 10,000. Feynman himself calculates the risk at 1 in 100. With corrections in the solid rocket booster system, that risk might be improved, he says, to 1 in 1,000. Such numbers, however inaccurate they may have been, were the basis of NASA claims that the shuttle was safe enough for civilians to fly. Feynman believes top NASA officials ordered more safety-conscious lower engineers to keep their mouths shut when they disagreed with radical safety projections.
The top people telling Congress things that were obviously impossible. They say, hey, we can't do this. Look, we can't do this. Look, we can't do that. Just be quiet. We're trying to get money.
Okay, now, let me talk a little about that. This is talk about the engineers at NASA and the engineers at Morton Thiokol. What's the problem? What estimates did you hear on the likelihood that the rocket O-rings were going to fail? It went from 1 in 1,000, maybe 1 in 100, according to this last, to 1 in 100,000. 1 in 100,000, he said, was on the basis of something that was just made up, pulled out of the air. Now, how did that happen? What's the situation such that these engineers, these good Mormon engineers, got themselves in a position where two things happened? One, they tended to modify their understanding of the likelihood that something was going to go wrong according to the situation in which they found themselves. And second, even if they thought they were right, even if they had good judgment to offer, it was not accepted. Do you know what's happened to those engineers, the ones that he was talking about low on the totem pole, who had insisted from the very beginning that there was something wrong with the O-rings and that the rocket shouldn't fly? They're lower on the totem pole. What this organization has done has responded by attempting, at least in this particular instance, which is brought to our considerable attention, it's not likely to happen, but what they've tried to do is demote the people who saw another way of looking at things. Now, we have to step back a little. All of a sudden we have something that's gone wrong and everybody's pointing fingers. It isn't as if everybody thought something was wrong to begin with. Imagine the situation these engineers are in. They're saying this thing is going to fail when it's never failed. They're saying that we may have to turn our contracts over to somebody else because we may not be able to develop the engineering strategies that allow these rockets to go. They're under what I refer to as distortion pressure. It's true in a lot of these situations that nobody knows what the truth is, but you can expect bureaucratic tendencies to go in a particular direction, to think that we're going to be more profitable than we're going to be, to think that the rockets that we're building are safer than they're likely to be, and so on. It's a tremendous social consequence of the fact that one doesn't know these things for sure. And it's hardly ever the case that one knows them for sure. There's a version of this that somebody I've been working with called the, I think a marvelous phrase, the over-advocacy trap. The over-advocacy trap. We'll come back to this in a lot of ways. This distortion pressure, the examples I gave in the first couple lectures were all the good old boys in industry, and I don't want it to be misheard that way. When we were in China, how many have been to China here? How many people have heard, or it certainly was true in the mid-70s when I was there, the big phrase was, learn from the Chai. Learn from the Chai. There was this agricultural commune that was on the side of the mountain, carved out from nothing. People, it was all about self-reliance. And in spite of the fact that the land was arid, in spite of the fact that it was very difficult to pull anything off, these people had managed to turn a desert into a flowering garden. They were growing not as much as you could anywhere in the world, but more than one would have anticipated under the circumstances anywhere in the world. They had pulled off miracles. This phrase was hanging in the middle of Tiananmen Square and everywhere else you turned. It was a rallying cry for the nation. It was the way in which everybody understood that self-reliance could work in China back then when they believed it. Now, under the new administration, it turns out the whole thing was made up. That the fellow who was in charge of that commune was on the Politburo, and under pressure, it's become quite evident that they never achieved the circumstances that they seemed to achieve. They were under tremendous, what I call, distortion pressure to make things look like they come out better than they would. And frequently, these things are a response to something that comes into the public eye. If an agency, I'm going to talk a lot about, and with the help of my friends, I hope, who've had experience in agencies, I've had some conversations recently. It frequently happens that agencies are beholden somehow to the government. Their funding is funneled through federal sources, for example. agencies that do something about delinquents are an example that I happen to have had a lot of experience with. In order to be funded to intervene with, let's say that you believe you can do something about the problem of delinquency in your community, and you're one of 10 organizations that are hustling to get a grant because you can't pull off any of it without a grant. And the guidelines come in, and one of the things the guidelines say is, to what percent of delinquency in your community will you reduce? Now, if anybody's had experience in this world, and particularly experience with these tough populations, one of the things you're likely to do is recognize that 2%, 3%, you make a marginal difference with all the resources you can command, that's success. You can't say that to the federal government. They can't fund an agency that says it's going to have a 3% impact as the chosen agency. So you say 20%. You say 40%. There's somebody out there you're competing with that also says 40%, so you say 45%. Okay, now what do you do in that situation? Your technology for intervening on delinquencies isn't improved, but you have some paperwork that has to be dealt with. So all of a sudden you find ways in which success comes your way. First, there's paper success. If you don't know what happened, let's pretend it went well. Or another thing you can do is a problem that is true in many of these situations called creaming. I don't know how many of you know about creaming. The people you take into your agency as clients are the people who least need your services, because they're the ones you're most likely to be successful with. So the tendency is to take the least tough cases, not the ones the agency was ever set up for. Not toughest cases, the ones that were set up for, but instead the least tough cases. It's a very frequent phenomenon in the real world of trying to pull something off, whether it's in education. I can judge how well I did in a class, not by the people that were present, but by the three people who come up to me afterwards and say, that was a terrific lecture. Okay. That, if you tend to let your judgment be biased by those kinds of understandings, then you can get yourself in real trouble. So that's a problem. I'm trying to identify a problem that a lot of people have. Well, one thing I want to be able to talk about here, and I think that the Morton Thiokol is an example of, is we don't know until now that those engineers were right. We only know because the O-rings failed. There are probably 26 people out there talking about other parts that are going to fail, right? But this one happens to come to our attention. But the issue was that the way the organization dealt with this is to suppress it. Suppress it during the fact and suppress it after the fact. One thing I think it's very important to try to introduce into an organization is minority reports of some sort. Some regular mechanism by which somebody who disagrees has an opportunity to express that opinion. It's a tough thing to do. Ombudsmen are even tough when they seem to stand some distance. But some way in which you try to guarantee that these people have a chance to be heard, and I'll come back to this a little bit, particularly when we talk about issues with delinquency, which I'll be especially interested in. Now, another thing I want to be very clear to at least get on the table is our needing to be sure we're well aware of the context within which these decisions are being made, whatever the decisions are. That often, what is it that, blocking out her name right now, somebody from the Algonquin Roundtable, Dorothy Parker, said about Katharine Hepburn, I think it was, that she could display all the emotions from A to B. Well, there's a problem sometimes in organizations that their sense of options is severely limited by those things which they've done in the past, or by those things which they think make sense, or by those things they've been able to pull it off, or in some other way terribly constrained. Constrained judgment is a real problem in most of these situations. I had, for me, an ennobling experience that's turned around my thinking about this some years ago. We were very interested in client evaluation, which I think I'll come back with, ways in which the clients participate in deciding whether something has worked or not. This experience was trying to look at an agency of a set of placements for kids who were treated as dependent and neglected in Illinois. Kids who'd been taken out of their homes because the homes weren't behaving appropriately and had been placed in some alternative institution. I worked very hard to get kids themselves on the team of evaluators of these institutions. So the kids went with us. Now, we went to one place that struck me as a particular problem. And I was really surprised after we'd spent several days there that this young girl, I think girl is appropriate, she was about 14 or 15, thought it was terrific. The rest of us were racking our brains trying to figure out how to make it better. And this judgment I was hoping to illuminate our thinking was that there's no problem here. This is a pretty good place. People can get along with one another. You have a lot of people to talk to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, with this judgment firmly fixed, we sat down to write a report, and one of the things that you're very interested in is the economics of it. When she sat with us, she heard for the first time in her life that her foster parents were being paid to keep her. It was a riveting experience. She grabbed some paper from me. She happened to be sitting next to me, and first she asked, how much are they getting paid? Then she started to write. And she did, and while we went on, she interrupted later to stand up and say, I want to tell you something. There's me and there's my five brothers and sisters. We were taken out of our home because my mother didn't have any money. She said, if my calculations are correct, and you had paid my mother half as much or less as you have paid these foster parents, we could have kept the family together. Now, she said, let me tell you about this institution. She said, my judgment is against all the foster homes I've been in. I was abused in one. I was kicked from place to place. They weren't a bit interested in me. And essentially, after we developed this and thought it through, she, when you ask how is this place, she can only consider it against a range of what seemed to her to be viable alternatives. And the viable alternatives were a range of very pernicious foster homes, which she happened to be in, and which she knew, at least in the case of some of her siblings, they had been in as well. When you elevate the opportunity structure in such a way that one of the possibilities is going home, she has a very different way of thinking about this. So opening up our understanding of what the options might be and trying to respond to the options that make the most sense, at least where they're possible, I think is really very important. I think now may be the time. I have, because I also want to, I want to talk a little about based upon a videotape I want to show you. What do you think the likelihood is that an inner city kid in Chicago, or let's say New York, because that happens to be this example, is going to drop out of school? The schools are awful. Do you know what the statistics are in inner city schools? 40, 45. In some schools they're worse. There are some schools where nobody stays. They're just incredibly bad. I've sat in a lot of seminars where the discussion was how do we make this better? How do we get it up? How do we get it down to 30% or 40%? How do we
25% nationwide?
How do we encourage these kids to stay? How do we work out alternatives that make sense? Is it good teacher training? Maybe that's what we need. We got to get the best teachers into those schools. The options all had to do with the circumstances we understood as possible within the domain that one typically operates when making these decisions. I'm going to show you a videotape, but we can talk a lot about this, but I want to do it and move on, from 60 Minutes about a man named Lang in New York who saw things rather differently. It started out with he was from a school, an inner city school in Harlem, where he, now a rich businessman, was invited back to talk about what might be done in these schools. And he was supposed to give one of these typical upbeat graduation talks to the students in this school. Let's turn and watch this for a minute and let it sink in.
Good
is finally coming.
True.
This is one of those stories which, if Hollywood were producing it, the headline would read, "Millionaire with Heart of Gold Offers Hope to Ghetto Kids." You know, something really schmaltzy like that. Well, this isn't Hollywood. This is 60 Minutes. And our headline is, "Millionaire with Heart of Gold Offers Hope to Ghetto Kids." It's 7:30 in the morning, and already Eugene Lang, who likes getting an early start, is on his way to work. Lang lives on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. There the hard way. He grew up poor, washed dishes in a restaurant to help support his parents during the Depression. Today, age 67, Eugene Lang is a rich industrialist, founder of the Refac Technology Development Corporation, a self-described penny pincher who rides buses rather than squander his money on cabs and limousines. Less than 2 miles from where Lang lives, Janet DeJesus lives in the projects. In a city the size of New York, it's unlikely that Lang and Janet would ever have met. Nor would Lang have crossed paths with Ski Bing, who lives with his mother and two brothers in Harlem. Yet several years ago, Eugene Lang did something that brought him into contact with Ski Bing, Janet DeJesus, and a lot of other inner city kids. Something that changed their lives and his.
Well, I was seated in a chair right over there. The podium was here, right center stage. And there, all arrayed in front of me, were all of these bright, young, shiny faces in blue caps and gowns.
The year was 1981. Eugene Lang was about to give the commencement address to the sixth grade class here at PS 121 in Harlem. A half century before, Lang himself had gone to this school, gone on to graduate from college and become a self-made multimillionaire.
I was really frantically groping around in my mind. What am I going to say? What am I going to say? How am I going to make these kids look at me?
What he was about to say to the 61 graduates was the same old stuff. Stay in school, work hard, you too can become rich and successful.
And I suddenly realized that anything I had to say that was ordinary, conventional, would be completely out of place, would be completely meaningless.
He found himself increasingly uncomfortable with the speech as he prepared it, and Gene Lang decided to put his money where his mouth was.
I said to them that I will give each one of you $500 that will be applied against your tuition at college for each of the 4 years that you will attend. But more than that, each year between now and the time you're ready for college, and that will be 6 years, I will increase that tuition commitment so that by the time you are ready for college and are accepted, there will be sufficient funds, a sufficient commitment up for your tuition so that you will be able to attend.
It was like, you know, a dream come true. No worries in the world towards education.
Who was this person coming out of nowhere, ripping up his speech and giving us, just throwing us money at him? I thought he was joking.
The atmosphere seemed completely electric. There literally was a gasp. The audience, literally a gasp. And as I stood there and heard that gasp, I thought to myself, well, today I am a man, you know. I really felt so good because I felt that I had come out and they were there and we had met and that we were together.
I was completely asleep. I was asleep, I was dead to the world, okay? And then this guy back here woke me up after what Mr. Lang said. And then after the graduation, we went to the principal's office where Mr. Lang was and we spoke to him to see what was really going on. And then when he explained it to us what he was gonna do and what his purpose was, it was like a complete surprise.
It was the stuff of fiction, a total stranger, rich, white, and older man, appearing out of nowhere and offering to pay the college tuitions of 61 black, Hispanic, poor kids. Some people just know how to make friends. This was film taken at that sixth grade graduation in 1981. Today, the kids are almost college age, they're juniors in high school, and Lang is getting ready to pay up.
How much money do you have? I really can't answer that because a lot of that depends on which way the market fluctuates. But I really don't spend my time thinking about that. All I can say is I have enough to support any commitment that I make.
But if the commitment, for instance, this commitment would not have bankrupted you?
Oh, not at all.
And you've given a lot of money in other ways to education?
Well, I've given to education in various forms over the last 15 years, probably at least $15 million.
At one point in his life, Eugene Lang considered becoming a social worker. But in college, he discovered an affinity for making money, and later, for giving it away.
Well, I don't believe in inheritance.
Your family agree with you?
Absolutely, absolutely. We spend hours talking about the things that we think should be done. And in our giving, we give significantly because I believe that's the only way to give. But apart from money, significant giving also means personal involvement.
Personal involvement was to become key to fulfilling Lang's promise, to which he gave a name, the I Have a Dream program. Lang quickly realized that putting up the money was easy. Now he had to find ways to make the program work. He had to keep his gang in school, get them all thinking about college, expand their expectations, build their self-esteem. Lang got in touch with the Youth Action Program Center in East Harlem and hired Johnny Rivera, a counselor at the center, to keep in constant touch with the kids and their parents.
Are you coming over tomorrow for the, on Tuesday for the writing workshop?
The exercise tonight we have to do is verb consistency.
Lang established a writing workshop and arranged free tutoring for college aptitude tests, the kinds of enrichment inner city public schools often fail to provide.
Mainly what this program has done for me is really, it's more or less motivated me to see how important college is and see how important education is. I mean, it's not going to just like end your life if you go to college. It's like, oh God, I'm going to college, I'm going to die. So the best thing to do is go to college, get an education, and then you work your way up from there. That's what Mr. Lang did.
Going downtown to see a successful businessman on Saturday morning, does that make you feel that you've broken out of your world and maybe into a little different world?
Well, so it gives you an idea that you know how to differentiate between your world, which is, you know, East Harlem, and up there on 42nd Street. It's like a whole different state of mind when you go up there to see Mr. Lang. It's like you're like a higher up. And when you're down here, you're just like everybody else.
You ask Steve Bing, Janet DeJesus, or any of the other kids what Eugene Lang is paying them, and they'll tell you that college tuition is the least of it. After all, there are scholarships and schools that don't charge much tuition. Lang is paying attention. That's the most important thing. He's taking an interest in their lives, providing inspiration, supporting their dreams.
Well, my dream is to win a Nobel Prize in Science.
Electronics technician. I want to become an architect, right?
Well, actually, I have two dreams. One is to become an executive secretary, and one is to become a professional dancer.
my dream is to be a computer programmer and systems analyst.
My dream is to be a successful entrepreneur.
Where'd you learn that one?
Well, my dream is to work with the physically handicapped.
I don't know. I guess I want to be rich.
Are they good kids? You like them?
Oh, I love them. I mean, I look at them now all of them as an extension of my family. When they come in and see me, I just delight in seeing them. I guess I talk to them in a way that were they actually my blood children, except probably they listen to me a little bit more carefully.
Wait a minute. Sir, why not? Why shouldn't you read poems the rest of your life? I don't mean you're not going to make a living reading poems.
I mean, I can understand reading them once in a while, maybe. See, I can't even think of a reason to read a poem.
Just for enjoyment.
Has Lang gotten results? Well, of the 61 kids in the class that he adopted, 11 have left New York. Of the 50 remaining, one wound up in jail. Three others are having problems and may not graduate from high school. All the rest, Lang says, are doing well enough to qualify for college. And that's very good, considering the high dropout rate for kids in the inner city. This is Bushwick High in Brooklyn, a fairly typical inner city high school. A school completely untouched by Gene Lang's philanthropy or anyone else's.
You know dropouts? I bet everybody in this room knows some dropouts.
Victor Herbert is a former high school principal in New York City who's leading a drive by public school officials aimed at preventing students from dropping out. Dr. Herbert says that if statistics are a guide, nearly half of these ninth graders at Bushwick won't finish high school.
Take a second to think why, and then tell us. Why do people drop out?
Sometimes there's people that, you know, that have kids and they can't become the school to attend their kids, you know. Because nowadays, young people have kids, you know.
Being lazy, they just don't want to get up in the morning and go out to school.
Some of them have problems in their home that they can't handle with. They can't deal with the problems, and so they figure that if home isn't some place for me to be, why should I be in school?
Because I know a lot of people, when I used to live in the Bronx, they used to, they're like 14 or 15 years old, and they sell drugs. They used to sell drugs in the hallway. They didn't go to school, and their family, some of them, they go to jail because of that. Because I got a friend that they went to jail because they caught him stealing drugs.
Do you think that someone like Mr. Lang doing something like that would help keep you in school?
Yes, ma'am. If someone like Mr. Lang is there to talk to you, you feel like quitting. If he's there to talk to you, you know, assure you, then it'll be a better chance of you not dropping out.
I agree with her because if we knew that we had someone there for us, whenever we had problems, it would be easier for us.
I would welcome Eugene Lang in every school I deal with, and there are moments when I think that we almost need a Eugene Lang for each student in the system. You know, you think back to where education began, and Socrates gathered around himself three or four young men and gave them everything he had. Maybe we have to get back to that in some way.
He talked about this spreading from 1 millionaire to 100 millionaires or 1,000 millionaires, and each of them influencing a number of students. He said it can be thousands and thousands of students. What does that do for the millions and millions?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think the millionaires will run out before the potential dropouts will run out. It's like the lifeguard jumping in the water, deciding which one out of 10 he's going to pull in. We have to find a way to keep people out of dangerous water.
What about you? You didn't graduate, did you? Okay, what are you doing now?
Well, me?
Yep.
Hanging out in the street.
If mostly teenagers had the opportunity that we had, I think most of them would be in school right now.
They like you?
I like to think so, but you never can be sure. But I can't stop and worry about that.
It's not like we're privileged just to know him. It's that he has given us the privilege of knowing what he knows, his knowledge, which we can use to benefit us.
I'm just happy to live in the illusion that they mean, I mean something to them, because I know that they mean a great deal to me. And somehow or other, I think the chemistry of caring tends to be a reciprocal. You give it, you get it.
That may be the most important commencement speech ever made to a grade school.
I'd like to think so. If it turns out to be that way, I can honestly say this life will have been worth living.
Well, any comments? I'm going to disagree with him a lot and with those kids, because you notice the explanations they gave. Typically, they're better, by the way, their presentations of Lang, but this is one that I was able to make available. The explanations, did you notice that they gave for their friends who weren't in school were family problems, drug problems, laziness, they wouldn't get up in the morning. Which of those things weren't true of these kids, or weren't equally their potential as they are for the potential for all the rest of these kids? In a sense, this is a very good experimental design. because this class wasn't different from the classes before and after it. If you look at the data from that school, it's surrounded by dropouts. All the other classes are classes of dropouts. And with this handful, really, in the larger picture of kids, they're not dropouts. And I don't think it has anything to do with drugs themselves. I think people fall into drugs because something else, because of lack, because they don't have any vision of what else might happen. And I think the main thing that Lang gave these people was vision. He made them look to a future that might mean something. There was something the other side of high school that had stability to it. I mean, this is the first time anybody offered them a real shot. It's not true that there are no caring teachers in inner city schools. Other kids have had people they could turn to. I don't think Lang distinguishes himself by his charisma with these kids. I think he distinguishes them by the real shot he gave them. And that's the thing that distinguishes him from a lot of other people in a lot of other situations. There's a tremendous difference, if you look at some of the fast food restaurants, between the likelihood that blacks or whites will keep jobs. Black turnover is much higher among youth. If you talk to the kids, for the white kids in these same McDonald's restaurants, let's say, they're on their way somewhere. And this is a part-time job to get a little money together, to get them a few extra things, and then they're going to move on. And if you talk to the typical inner city black kid at these places, they would say this is maybe the best job we'll ever have. They're not on their way anywhere. They don't have the same incentive to stick with it because they don't see the future in the same way as do the other people. And I think it's a very important, the main thing that Lang has brought is a way in which you can think about bringing potential to a situation that might not have been there otherwise. Okay, a speech. Does anybody else have any comments on this? I find it to be quite a provocative take.
I think the one area that dealing with some kids like that is the whole area of self-esteem, which he mentioned at
right.
point two of the kids. They felt better about themselves as people within gave them some perspective or some vision, as you say. I didn't think the money, however, in spite of the generosity of the secondary, which he seemed to indicate too, with those kids. I'm dealing with a project in Seattle that relates to street kids, to looking at a model for a street kid. And we met with a bunch of kids on Saturday, like that, Indian kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, and a group of people to ask about their vision for themselves. It relates a lot of that in somewhat more difficult terms because they are not in any kind of, they didn't even have a 6th grade graduation or in that process. They're out of it completely. They're on the street, fighting to live on the street. And so, but the one element that in dealing with those kids that they raise up, first of all, is respect, self-respect, self-esteem. The people associated with them, rather interestingly, the concept of holistic kinds of factors that relate to the spirit as well as the mind and body.
Anyone else?
I think if there were fighting with these problems with a lot of our families in normal living too. I'm at a school where I think 75-80% of the families are one parent families. The kids have no one at home when they go to school, no one at home when they go home from school. That's what we call Lapsy Kids. And in our high school, they started a program called Something Hands. And they're teaching high school kids that are nominated by the students themselves a training of listening. And they are listening to their own peers and seeking help for the suicidal and those that are that need that help. It's been very successful. And I think sometimes they just don't have anyone at home to listen to them.
Yeah, sure.
Are you underestimating the effect of the cold cash?
Well, that's I was. Let's Am I? Is the, I mean, is the cold cash being underestimated? That's,
this all sounds like if we're nice human beings to each other, and especially to deprived kids, well, they'll do better. And somehow the vision can be given and so on. That, it seems to be very important that that hard cash was out on the line.
Now, he didn't enhance the self-esteem of these kids by having a good therapist see them every day. If their self-esteem went up, it was not due to therapeutic intervention, but to something very practical that had meaning in their future. So I think that's can't be overlooked. I mean, and it seems to me that it's an extraordinary enough outcome. If you look at this against any other inner-city school, I know that it's an experiment not only worth looking at, but replicating to see if it has similar effects elsewhere. I'm quite sure that it will, yeah.
I also think that the effect of community is important to look at, because our attempts in Chicago to take individual or one or two kids out of school and get them to college and get them scholars and get them and sort of take an interest and know their families has universally failed. And I think part of it is that they didn't have a collective of people who were all on that road, and where they would all learn to take college boards, they would all learn to, I mean, they don't know, you know, our friends haven't known how to get their stuff notarized for a college board.
Right.
How did they get it notarized and anything like that? And then they don't know where to get their college board paper. They don't know. So each step is such a hurdle. But if you were doing it with 60 people who were your peers, and you were all being taken to do these steps by some adults who were assuming you were going to go to college, that would help a lot.
You know, it's a very interesting program in Cabrini Green that tries to do that with people in jobs. And we should talk about after, but I don't think I have time to develop it now. Okay, there's so much I want to cover. Let me just put in some general things that I think have to be mentioned in organizational settings, which is where I've had the most experience and where I can hope I can get you to speak on too. One of them is counter-bureaucratic tendencies, which are always of a certain kind. They're bureaucratic tendencies that mean we've got relationships with, we're an agency. It's supposed to be figuring out what the appropriate placement is for a child, but we've got a contract with this place out here and they've got some empty beds. Maybe it makes sense to send some kids to those beds. Or the money is directed more to a certain kind of program than another type of program. And so it's more likely that we're going to make decisions that are aligned with that money. Those are typical kinds of things that happen. It struck me that often it's not appropriate in the situations I know to make any decisive initiative of any kind and stick with it, as if the world doesn't change, as if placements don't change, as if kids aren't themselves malleable. It is important, however, to have good information and to consider all the possibilities as openly as possible when, for example, child placement decisions are made. One thing that we thought about doing in Chicago, but were never able to pull off, was this, that it seems to me that there should be two people in an office, if you're talking about child placement, with almost Gilbert and Sullivan-like titles. I'm the person in charge of making sure that nobody gets taken out of their home unless they really have to be. And I'm the person in charge of making sure that everybody leaves the home that has to. And they're supposed to take on those roles and sit down and consider every case and make an adversary case, an adversary position on behalf of each of those, so that you know that you've thought through all the tendencies, because typically what you get in offices are people who think about things for whatever reason so much alike that there's a whole side of things, maybe that rocket shouldn't go off after all, that doesn't get a chance to surface. And if that were built in, that might be really useful. I'm going to say something that I know is going to be offensive to some people in agencies, but it is a precise enough conclusion from some work we did with children that I want to bring it up. There's a man named John Brown that runs a set of places called Browndales for children. He's for-profit, so he's anathema to the not-for-profit community typically. He flies around in a Learjet, and so people are very concerned. That's the most important thing about him. Well, we have the same way of thinking about him as everybody else until we talked to 400 kids who've been in institutions. And it was uniformly the case, no matter how many institutional placements they had, and no matter where this was, the Browndale, on its string of placements, that these were the best places these kids had ever been. It was without exception the case. So we had to look into this guy very carefully. And we found out a variety of things. For example, one of the reasons he has a Learjet is he does the selection of staff himself. Everywhere in the world, he has placements in Amsterdam, he has placements in Canada and in Illinois and a variety of other places. And he says there's nothing more important than who the people are that are doing the work. Now he has certain criteria that he uses for those people. For example, they can't have a degree in social work. He will not take anybody who has a degree in social work. Number two, they can't stay more than 2 years. Because he regards these as what he calls therapeutic families. He wants you to treat these kids like siblings and not like a social worker that has to go home at 5. And so he wants to look at it like the Peace Corps. And he wants to work, he wants people to burn out. He expects people to burn out. Otherwise, what happens is a routine gets set up so that, you know, your needs must be over, my day is over. We worked with one person there was a student who was working in one of the ghetto areas in Chicago who said that when she first was doing some interviewing there, people were regarding her very peculiarly, and then later they said to her that they figured she must be a prostitute. They knew she wasn't a social worker because she was there after 5 and on Saturdays. Okay, that's not the way the social work issue manifests itself typically in many of these situations. Now there are always exceptions, and I don't want to get caught up in that, but I do want to present alternatives because John Brown is bucking the trend vigorously. He thinks there's nothing more important than caring, and what you have to do is keep the caring in, whatever form that takes. And that takes some very strong and vigorous steps that can never be denied, and particularly in the case of child care. There are some other principles that he uses as well, but I think those are probably the most important. Now, let me carry this a step further. I have to get somebody up and yelling at me or we won't have had a good talk. There was a very interesting case in Chicago where some children, where a worker was fired. The worker was fired for having shot a parent. That seems perfectly reasonable. But it's another case that seemed extraordinary enough to look into. And what happened was that there was a very abusive father. This father was very wealthy and had lots of good lawyers. And so 3 times in a row, this worker had gone to court with this child that he knew was being abused. And he had watched this lawyer talk the judge into sending the kid back home to be abused again. And it happened repeatedly. And finally, and this person did some awful things. This worker took the kid home with him and got in trouble for that after one of these incidents. Well, the 4th time he shot the father. I don't think it was fatal, but he did it. Now, there are some things that I hope to be able to highlight with this. First, the most important thing is, as far as we can tell, this worker cared very deeply about this child and was totally torn apart by how the bureaucracy and the legal system, as he understood it, was treating with this case. More important than ever to me, more important than that in this case, was that the agency responded by building up a set of barriers that made sure this thing would never happen again. No kid was ever to be taken home by a worker. The rules made sure that the opposite parent and the worker would never be in court in a situation where such a thing was likely to happen. They built up a set of barriers that tried to invest in what this particular agency was up to by protecting itself against any kind of reaction like that in the future. As far as I could tell, this is one of the most caring workers that we've seen. To put it extravagantly, it might be that if a parent gets shot every once in a while, that's a sign of health in an agency. One thing that happens is a variety of barriers get set up to the caring relationships between kids who are wards of the state and agencies that are trying to do something. Now, when those get out of hand, obviously you have to react to them. But the reactions are often to build ledger upon ledger of rules that allow you not to get in that problem again, but also not to develop a caring relationship with a child. It's the kind of thing you get in trouble for, rather than being rewarded for when you get into bureaucratic situations. Why don't you tell us a little about your downstate experience?
Okay, I spent the last year working in a home for abused, neglected children, generally classified as emotionally disturbed, and borderline personality, character disorders as well. And in the agency that I worked with, I saw a lot of changes over that in the past year when I came, that we were given quite a bit of freedom. We were very much encouraged to spend a lot of time with children one-on-one. We're very important. I was assigned 10 girls, and within those 10, I was given 3 that were my responsibility to spend time with each week. One-on-one, we went out for Cokes, we went to the zoo, we went shopping, and we did things just one-on-one, and spent a lot of time with that. On the unit that I worked with, there was one male staff member and 3 female regular workers, and I saw some very positive relationships working out of what became to be special relationships, girls that I grew very attracted to and could be very close to. I wasn't that much older. Some of them were as old as 18 in my agency. I'm in my 20s, and so it wasn't really a kind of authoritarian, even though certainly at times it had to be that I was the one that had the authority. But I saw some very dramatic changes because of an incident of abuse that took place, like not in the unit of 10 girls I was working on, but in a...
No, go ahead, please.
But then in a unit of 10 boys by their therapist. And the therapist is a brilliant man. He graduated from the University of Chicago and always impressed me as someone who was very caring. A lot of the therapists were like he said. You know, I was a child care worker on the unit, lots and lots of hours, as many as 16 a day was very normal. But therapists were there just for 9-to-5 type things. And he was always there later. He was there in the evenings, and he was there on weekends, and he took them home, and he had barbecues for his kids. And in January, it came up that for quite some time, perhaps more than a year, he had been sexually abusing the boys on his unit. And giving those boys special favors, special privileges, extra money, and everything changed in our agency. For one thing, I was working with 10 girls who had all been sexually abused, and they began to act out all over the place. They had, for the first time, many of them had felt safe being there, and all of a sudden they weren't safe anymore. And they started running away, and they started fighting, and they started beating up on staff members, and we just had all kinds of problems. But as a result of that, just as he was saying, the bureaucracy came down on us. And all of a sudden, there were to be no special relationships with children. You never go one-on-one with a child anywhere. They never come to your home. And we were locked into a situation where we were staying on a unit all the time, just because we couldn't go anywhere. You know, we couldn't take them out someplace. You know, I couldn't run somewhere with a couple of girls, even to the store. Added to that were a series of seminars that we had, and the most important thing we learned, that you need to protect yourself. You can be set up, you can be put in a situation where you can abuse someone, it's not worth it, and you need to protect yourself. So, you know, I was never on the unit by myself. I would never go into someone's room. We used to go around every night, the 2 staff together, and give everybody hugs and say goodnight, and that was absolutely forbidden. And the bureaucracy, the things we had to report to the DCFS, we also were working for a church, we had to report to them. And things changed overnight.
Well, I've tried. So I want to point out both sides of this. The one side is, obviously, if there's somebody who's abusing like this, you have to do something. But the tendencies that follow that are often more pernicious than the thing you started with. There's a lot more we can talk about. We're out of time. Some of the things which I put together a collection of readings that are in the Holden bookstore, and there are a couple here called Proactive Records, Record Keeping, and Big Brother in a Box you might be interested in. The next thing I'm going to talk about is totally different. It's computers versus education. There are a lot of articles here about computers in school settings that you also might want to look at, especially if you're going to be able to come next time. Thank you very much.